So as I said before, we'll just move right into the sit. I'm going to ask each of us to come into a seated posture or lying down that allows you to feel upright and alert. And it's not so much the posture of alertness, but more an energetic availability to this awareness of this moment and then of this moment. Ideally, the body can be relaxed, and it may be helpful just to round the shoulders up and down and back as a way of opening the chest. As I said before, perhaps leaning back literally or energetically to kind of occupy the back body. And in these early moments of any sit, to allow yourself to locate yourself in the body. May just be resting in the lower half, feeling again your legs, your feet on the floor. In the somatic experiencing training, Peter Levine would talk about resting our awareness just inside the lower spine, sort of behind the belly button, but closer to the spine. Of dropping down and in. And as women, we sort of carry so much of our power in what can also be called the front part, in the dantian. It's below the belly button. Can we allow our energetics to rest there? It's a way of grounding, arriving, locating ourselves in this very body that is more than just the endless thought streams. And for the anchor of our sit today, I want to invite us just to stay in the body, this mindfulness of the body. And offer a couple alternatives. Maybe staying with the breath, allowing the attention to stay with one, one half, the inhale. Focusing on that inhale. And then there's that pause, and then the exhale. And I like this instruction of the half breath. It's a very short amount of time. I feel like it sets me up for success. Pay attention to a half breath in and that pause, and then a half breath out, that exhale. Breath in, breath out. And I know for some of us, staying with the breath, practicing with the breath, noticing the breath, it's not a neutral experience. Whether there's asthma, challenges with the lungs, myriad of ways that the breath is not neutral. Okay, then don't worry about staying with the breath, but instead allowing the attention to stay more in that realm of primary sensation, sort of what takes center stage. It might be the feeling of if your hands are holding each other, the pressure, the temperature of the hands, the bones of the hands connecting, interlocking perhaps. If the hand is resting on the legs, the pressure, again, heat, coolness. I know for me, sometimes, often, when I sit on the cushion, my leg will fall asleep. So it's a whole opportunity to pay attention to that, the different sensations that come. And allowing or inviting the part of us that wants to evaluate how we're doing, or perhaps offering gentle suggestions as to how we could do this better. Just let that go. Relying instead just on this gentle curiosity of, oh, this half breath in, this half exhale out, or this sensation, how is it Just to allow that to be enough. The part that's so committed to striving or getting better, doing something well, that part can just sit down, taking the megaphone away from that part of ourselves. And can we just lean more into this invitation of what if we just enjoyed our capacity for this fairly short amount of time to sit together as we pay attention to all the myriad of things that happen on a half in-breath, pause, exhale. And allowing our attention to be curious, precise, gentle. Knowing there's no such thing as a bad sit, we come, we take our seats. With this idea of just meeting ourselves just as we are, half breath at a time, moment by moment, with this welcoming softness that we would extend to one of our beloveds. So nice to sit together, as always. Actually, open with a poem. Felt appropriate on this second day of summer by Mary Oliver. Some of you know this, I'm sure. The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And I know this is one of those poems that comes up a lot in Dharma talks at one of my daughter's school. That was one of the quotes, what will you do with this wild and precious life, on the wall. And in its ubiquitousness, it can kind of in some ways lose its meaning. And wanting to play around today with this notion of time and energy and maybe even idleness, but more in the sense of how do we actually want to live this life? I've been reading a book called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. And the idea is basically if we live to be 80, if we're lucky enough to live that long, it's about 4,000 weeks. And this is an undeniable fact. Our time is finite. And he's a journalist. He used to be specialized in time management and wrote all these guru books on how to manage our time, and came to the conclusion that it's all worthless. It doesn't work at all. The book is sort of surprisingly hilarious at points, but what the message, and it so dovetails with the teachings of the Dharma, but the Oliver Berkman's point is we're only here for a very short amount of time. And if we just can lean into that reality as, oh, this is a truth. And the to-do list we have will always be longer and more detailed than we can ever accomplish. That is also true. Okay, then what? And it goes in sort of prioritizing and so forth, but sort of on the larger, more meta message of how do we orient ourselves towards the sense of time and this striving so many of us can have to be productive, such that it's made us, it's become, for many of us, it is for myself, I see it in my daughter, with the teen clients I have, colleagues, friends, it's really hard to find ways to actually relax. And this refrain, I'm sure many of you have this too, but always being tired, as if somehow that's a problem to be, that it can be managed with enough caffeine or eating the right foods or whatever. But there's a way in which, whether it's so wherever we are in COVID, post-COVID, the stage of COVID, the intensity of the last couple of, well, many years, it's been fatiguing in a way that can be, take such a toll on the body, but almost like the frog in the boiling water, that it's not until like really exhausted or sick that we start to take stock of, is this working? The way that it's not the scheduling of our life, but it's more our attitude towards this nature of time to be managed and to be efficient with and to sort of to really structure it. And I was thinking about 15 years ago, a number of my family members and I, we did this river trip in the Yukon on the Tatashini River, and it's 10 days. And it was midsummer, so it was daylight always until, well, it never got dark. And the guides on the trip said, you know, take your watch off. And no one, we didn't think we had phones, well, because it was 15 years ago. And to take your watch off because time doesn't matter. And we don't want you to keep track of time. Okay. And at the end of the trip, they said, well, so just in a guess, what time do you think we all ate dinner? And we're like 7, 8. He's like, no, we had dinner at like 11:30 or 12 at night. Like, what? We didn't know. We weren't on a clock, but we were in this rhythm. We woke up, whatever time we woke up, we got ready, we had breakfast, we got on the river, we moved forward. And it was very similar rhythm on this last rafting trip that I've mentioned. And I don't mean to keep going on and on about these rafting trips, but as Richard Rohr, the Franciscan priest, points to, the different, this chronos time, the tracking of time, time on a watch, time on our phone, the appointments we meet from West Coast time, Pacific Coast time, from 10 until 12. And then many of us probably have obligations at 12:15, that there's that clock ticking time. And what Richard Rohr speaks about is deep time. And deep time, and let me quote from him. It's on my phone. Apologies. Not there. Chronological time. Time is duration, one moment after another. And that's what most of us think of as time. But there's another word in Greek, kairos. And kairos was deep time. It was when you have those moments when you say, oh my God, this is it. Or this is as perfect as it can be, or oh, it doesn't get any better than this. Or this is the moment summing up the last 5 years of my life, things like that, where time comes to its fullness and the dots connect, where we learn how to more easily go back to those moments or to live in that kind of space, that it could be considered a contemplative time, but more in the Mary Oliver sense of, oh my God, check out this grasshopper. And how much beauty can come by paying attention to the stroll, walking through the fields, or this grasshopper, or this sunrise, whatever, as opposed to contemplation that can be kind of prayer driven, like I'm going to talk to God and I'm going to ask for this and play out my problems, or I'm going to meditate in order to get somewhere, to get to a better place, to get to enlightenment or get to more ease, that we can be so oriented towards this in order to get there. The Mary Howe again, sorry for my phone. Mary Howe's poem, Marie Howe, sorry. Hurry, we stop at the cleaners and the grocery store and the gas station and the green market and hurry up, honey. I say, hurry up. As she runs along two or three steps behind me, her blue jacket unzipped, her socks rolled down. Where do I want her to hurry to? To her grave? To mine? Where one day she might stand all grown? Today, when all the errands are finally done, I say to her, honey, I'm sorry. I keep saying, hurry, you walk ahead of me. You be the mother. And hurry up, she says, over her shoulder, looking back at me, laughing. Hurry up now, darling, she says. Hurry, hurry. Take the house keys from my hands. You know, this way we can hurry ourselves into what exactly? Into somewhere better, somewhere where we're more organized, where all our to-do list things are done. No, that place doesn't exist. And how do we allow ourselves to soften into, oh, right, actually, no. What if I remove that pressure of expectation of the self-improvement project that can seem to be never ending as a place of striving and moving away out of this moment into some other better place? Is it there? Not so much. And so how do we, within the confines of there are things that we have to do. There are obligations in the course of a day. Okay. Some we will get done. Okay. And then what? How do we relate to the fact, that fact, that at the end of the day, like, oh, shoot, there's all these things I didn't do. Okay. But being able to understand, yes, that's part of this life. That is part of the, I never know what the phrase is, the weft and woof, woof. I'm not a knitter, but the sort of it's woven into the fabric of our lives, of this challenge, the paradox really of there, maybe all these things we want to do, all these things we have to do, and we have 4,000 weeks in which to do them. If we are lucky, you know, 24 hours in the day, and this fantasy that we have of, if I can just figure it out better, then I'll be able to get all this stuff done. Not so much. And coupled with that, the striving can be an impatience of the hurry up, the turning over the shoulder, like hurry up. there was just the other day, my daughter and I, we were stopped to get coffee and something to eat. And there was a lot of people there that no one had any coffee cups in front of them. And I looked at her like, I think this is going to take a while. And she asked the woman, like, how long is this going to take? And the woman said, about five or six minutes. And my daughter and I both like, oh, well, we can't possibly wait, which was kind of true because we didn't have somewhere to be. But I was thinking about this morning, like, that's ridiculous. Like, we didn't have 5 minutes. And that was the perception that we had. And that if, and I'm aware in myself, if I don't pay attention to things like that, I can actually believe, oh no, I don't, I couldn't possibly have 5 minutes. Really? Huh. But this attitude we have, like, hurry up. Everything needs to be accountable for different things. And being able to check ourselves, is this how we want to live? We don't have that much time. And then when I was in law school, there was experience of really long, long minutes. Some of the classes, forgive me for all the lawyers out there, were so boring or just so hard. But then time went by really quickly because all of a sudden we were in exams. But the stretching, moving sense of time, and certainly in COVID, time got really weird too. But how do we cultivate a relationship with time that might be somewhere in between the chronological, I don't possibly have 5 minutes, or the deep time when we really have enough time to reset ourselves, when we sit longer retreats, than longer by which I mean longer than 4 or 5 days. Those of you who have sat them know those first 3 days are kind of brutal. But even in, for those of you who have ever, like a week vacation, it still takes a couple days to unwind, to kind of almost, I don't really like this word, but almost detoxify ourselves from the stress and pressure and moving in increments of time. That it takes a while for the body to reset, to come back into the body's natural rhythm. This body of ours evolved outside on the plains, not inside on computers when in increments of 5 or 10 minutes. When before I went to law school, I was a minion in a law firm. And I kid you not, we had to record our times. I think it was either in 3 minutes or 6 minutes. That was what we needed to account for. So every hour, like, okay, for the 6 minutes or 3 minutes, I, again, it's a certain way of working. That's how it had to work in the firm. Okay. But the way we can internalize the sense of we have to always be accountable or productive or striving makes it really hard to relax. It makes it really hard to be idle. And in the kind of dominant puritanical culture that is still some on some levels alive and well, this idleness, you know, that's where we get into trouble, really. And how do we watch where we're caught in certain conditionings about our relationship to time? In the impatience part, I want to read this because I read it and I just cracked up. This partnership between our relationship to time and then where we can have a real sense of our own impatience towards ourselves. He's talking about, this is in this book, 4,000 Weeks, about the microwave. And I don't own a microwave, so when I do use it, I'm kind of a little clueless about it, as how much time actually thinks. So I said, once you can heat your dinner in the microwave in 60 seconds, it it begins to seem generally realistic that you should be able to do so instantaneously in 0 seconds. And that's all the more maddeningly frustrating that you still have to wait an entire minute instead. You'll notice how frequently the office microwave still has 7 or 8 seconds left on the clock for the last person who used it, a precise record of the moment at which the impatience became too much for them to bear. And I don't know why this totally cracks me up, because I've done that, like, oh, it's just done and take it out. Like, I can't wait the extra 7 minutes. But, and it just cracks me up of the absurdity, like, oh, that's totally, I've been there. As a way of just a reflection of, what am I doing? You know, this way we can get caught up. I don't possibly have time for that. And again, there are realities to limits, right? But how are we orienting towards those limits? We have inherited all of this deeply bizarre idea of what it means to spend your time off well, in quotes, and conversely, what counts as wasting time. In this view of time, anything that doesn't create some form of value for the future is by definition mere idleness. Rest is permissible, but only for the purposes of recuperating for work or perhaps for some other form of self-improvement. I'm going to take time off. I'm going to sit a retreat to learn to be a meditator. I'm going to take time off in order to do this course or to do this or to that. Again, a sense of betterment, all of which is wonderful. And it can be kind of this shadow side of this endless kind of push against time, which also can be a push against, oh, I'm actually going to die. My time is finite. It becomes difficult to enjoy a moment of rest for itself alone without regard for any potential future benefits, because rest has no instrumental value, because rest that has no instrumental value can feel wasteful. Why? Years ago, I read a book. I'm not going to be able to come up with a title, but it was about the Kosan people in Southern Africa. I don't think it's South Africa, Southern Africa. And very nomadic. They didn't really have much. It was not an abundant area. They had enough. And someone had worked it out that basically they worked, I think something like 15, 17 hours a week to be able to have their life be sustainable in terms of maintaining the food they had, the animals they had, if they had them, and tending to all the family members and the folks in the community. 17 hours a week. And the rest of the time was time off. Like that wasn't demanded in the terms of maintaining their life. And the book was coming from the point of, what does abundance actually mean in terms of today, how we'd think of abundance versus in that time. And this is written by an anthropologist, of the value of abundance. They had a lot of time to hang out, to be with other people, to be in conversations, to play. We've come kind of a far way away from the notion of having an idle time to play. And I see this with kids coming up. My daughter, her friends, again, the teens that I work with, there's such an overscheduling pressure. Well, you got to do this if you want to get into college, whether that's coming out of my mouth or just in the air that these kids are breathing, there's so much pressure. Hurry up, fill your day, have it be accountable, that it's onward leading. And for ourselves to be able to look at, what am I doing? And to come back to the teachings of the Buddha, the perfections of the heart, these 10 qualities, when we can allow ourselves to rest in expanding the capacities of our heart's energy, the wise use of energy, and patience are there as two of the 10 perfections of the heart. I'm going to read a little bit from Suchito's book, The Parmes. I used to read from this book all the time. It's one of my favorites. It is an ebook online. That's the cover, but I'm going to read a little bit if you'll indulge me. I love this guy. Okay. Let's consider energy or virya. Energy is fundamental for all of us and for anything that we do. When our energy is bright and steady, we feel good and we act effectively. And when it's low or shattered, we begin to feel bad and messed up. So energy is relevant both as a resource of vitality and as a way we apply that resource. Why bother? We all probably recognize that any development is going to depend on the consistent energy with which we apply ourselves. Where are we putting our energy? Where are we expending this? We can get involved in programs such as perfectionism or dependence on others or obsessive self-criticism and addictions that cripple our actions and our well-being and use up our resources. These programs can offer a security and of identity through a set of habits that kick in by default. So when the waves of insecurity or loneliness or fear or passion hits our awareness, when we're in one of those programs, we can just default into that, into the perfectionism or self-criticism or an addiction. The point he's making, that awareness has to widen beyond the waves and the programs. Its default is to be conditioned by the current span of attention, which I've read is our human current span of attention is about that equivalent of a goldfish. Attention appears, the conditioned current span of attention and what appears within that, and by intention, the direction of the heart. So when a program wells up, it floods our attention and our intentions tend to follow the push of that flood. Energy is needed to resist that flood and direct awareness to firm ground. Rather than brute force, energy is mostly about sustaining wise endeavor. The chief awareness is to keep awareness awake at the places where we drift into automatic. then its gift of steady vitality can replace the drive and crash program of habits. And we know that some of the habits that we can fall into, the sort of the false refuges, don't serve us. And at the end, if we drop into it, whether it's eating or sex or online shopping or Netflix or whatever, if done to excess, it's like, this does not make me feel good. Okay, so how do we come back to really look at how am I expending this energy? A wise response would be to say that the priority is how to learn to conserve energy and not dissipate it. What I love, I won't keep reading about it, but one of my favorite parts in that chapter on how do we hold our energy is not so much I don't have enough or I have too much, it's to say, this is the amount of energy I have. If I can align myself with what I truly value, and that becomes the filter. It's not this task is too much or that person is too draining or I can't possibly say yes to that because I don't have time. It's more allowing ourselves to rest and stand upon the firm ground of what we value. That becomes the filter. Is this endeavor, what I want to do, what I'm investing my time in, is it in alignment with what I hold dear, with what really matters to me? If we can stand in that alignment, we know what that constellation of our values looks like. That again becomes the filter. It can really change the way we view our expenditure of energy and also our relationship to time, because we're not fighting time to try and fit things in, but we're coming more from a place of, this is what's important to me. Can I invest my energy, my time, my resources, my creativity, all my life's vitality, my energy, in places that are gratifying? And by gratifying, that's not quite the right word, but more in a way that, let me rephrase that. Can I invest all of that into activities, conversations, movements of the body in ways that are nurturing and help steady the mind? I've said before, sometimes when we are working with our minds, there's that juncture of, is this thought stream, this way that I'm, what my mind's caught on, is it leading me to a place of stress or is there ease here? That same filter can apply to the way we use our body's energies, our life's vitality. Is what I'm engaging in stressing me out, or is what I'm engaging leading into a sense of ease? Again, there's a reality. There are certain things we have to do. Okay. What we can control is the attitude with which we do it. So again, I mentioned the impatience of, oh my God, the microwave is taking 7 seconds longer than I want. Okay. So then we look at that parami of patience to say, it's okay. What if I tell myself I have enough time, and trying that on? And the voice might be like, oh, honey, you do not. Okay, maybe, maybe not. If I take off the expectation, I'm going to get everything done. Okay. And even in the book, 4,000 Weeks, he's like, figure out what you want to fail at. What do you not want to be good at? He talks a little bit too of this notion of hobbies. And I won't look for it, but it's funny that hobbies have kind of been relegated to something, his words, something kind of pathetic, that we're not really very good at a hobby. And he's like, that's the whole point. Can we engage ourselves in things that we don't have to be great at? And for some reason, he pulls in Rod Stewart, the musician, as an example, who, when he travels on tour, he builds model cities of some combination of New York and Chicago, and it comes with him. He gets his own hotel room for his model world. And he's done it for decades. And he, by his own admission, is like, I'm not really very good at it, but I like it. And this idea of, what do we allow ourselves not to be very good at, but to really enjoy, without, again, this extra pressure of, I have to be good at it. And I can't tell you how many meditators I've talked to who are like, I'm not very good at this, or I should be better. I should be farther along. Why? Why do we think that? So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. One, just check in. That was a lot of me talking and just letting your attention come back into your body. And see what comes up when I offer the question, what do you truly value in your life? What matters to you? different questions, different flavors, but letting yourself be curious about when you're honest, truly. You know, this is, you have 2 months to live kind of question. What do you really value? What's important to you? And just to see what comes up, again, allowing there to be a wide net here, just to see what comes up and letting that be a repeating question. What really matters? What do I most value? And this could be the value of how do I want to show up in the world? What values? In the world of the 10 paramis, it's our use of energy and integrity, truthfulness, equanimity, metta, patience, resolve. It can be humor. It can be love. It can be connection, whatever it is. And allowing that question to distribute, what do I truly value? What matters to me? And we're all in different stages of life and conditions and situations. There are some things that are unavoidable. Okay. What do I value? How do I want to show up? What do I want to do with this one wild and precious life? Can we embolden each moment with that light, with that attitude, with that reference point, and not wait? What are we waiting for? And to imagine these values, as I mentioned before, creating this constellation in a way with perhaps in this moment, one that might feel a deeper connection, the deepest connection to, that's our North Star. Can this be our guide by which we invest our energies, our life's vitality, our heart, our goodness? Can we let ourselves, can we give ourselves permission to allow our lives, our resources, this one wild and precious life to be guided by that which we most value? And what might that look like? And what might that like feel like in that embodied sense of living a life in alignment to what we hold dear? So I'm gonna stop there. And again, thank you for your very kind attention.